Our scripture reading for this hour's lesson is found in 2 Samuel chapter 19. 2 Samuel chapter 19. And for now, we'll just look at the first verse. 2 Samuel 19 and 1. And it was told Joab, "Behold, the king weepeth and mourneth for Absalom." Once again, pleasant good morning to you. Thank you for being here, coming out, worshiping God in spirit and in truth on our day. It's cold, but it's warmer today than it was yesterday, so we count all of our blessings and we name them one by one. As we continue looking at 2 Samuel, a study of King David's successes and sins, we'll be in the 19th chapter here in just a moment. There's just 24 chapters, so we see the end in sight of this wonderful study today with a lesson titled, From Jordan to Jerusalem. A man walks into a fancy dining restaurant. The maitre d' says, "You're in luck. We're running a manager's special today only. We have 22-ounce ribeye steaks hanging 12 inches from the ceiling. If you can reach up there and grab it and pull it down, we'll cook it however you want. Two or three sides, a drink, a salad, a dessert, and we'll send you a dessert to go home at no cost to you. Would you like to try to jump up there and get that?" And the man said, "No, the stakes are too high." Last week was the destruction and death of Absalom, a disastrous destruction and death of Absalom. This week we see we're going to have to go from the Jordan River, which is where David is, and David's going to have to go back to the city of Jerusalem, hence our title for our lesson today, From Jordan to Jerusalem. Now, following the acts of Absalom, David could not avoid a period of strife and confusion. So if you think about it, a good number of the people thought Absalom was the king. Of course, a good number of people knew that David was still the king. Now Absalom is gone. The people that thought he was the king, what are they going to do? Are they going to return their loyalty to David where it should have remained the whole time? Are they going to try to appoint a successor? There's no way he could avoid a period of strife and confusion. Yet at the same time, poor old David is also part of the problem. And he's going to make his life harder on himself. Thankfully for Joab in this chapter, probably will save the kingdom. That may be a little too looking into it, but the actions of Joab in 2 Samuel 19, if they hadn't happened, I can't say that David's kingship would have remained the way it was. Now, God would have kept him as king. That was his plan all along, but he may not have been as strong of a king in the last few years of his reign. We're going to divide up our chapter in five things I know about David. There's just the easiest way to do it. Five things about David in chapter 19. And the first one, for the first 10 verses, David's cry. Now, if you remember, before we continue our reading here, the end of the 18th chapter, David is lamenting and he says, "Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would to God that I had died for thee." He wished he would have been killed instead of his son. That's how much he lamented the death of the son that was a traitor to him, yet he still loved his son. Well, David's going to continue to cry in this chapter. So we already read verse 1 that Joab was told the king is weeping and mourning for Absalom. And the victory, verse 2, that day was turned into mourning unto all the people. For the people heard it say that day how the king was grieved for his son. And the people got them by stealth that day into the city, as the people being ashamed steal away when they flee into battle. We see these valiant soldiers that had gone out and won the war in the woods that we talked about last week. They would be entitled to appreciation. They would be entitled to be applauded for their deeds. What do we do today when a soldier comes home from a tour of duty? We congratulate them, we appreciate them, we take them out to eat, we have a celebratory time. They deserve to be recognized for their deeds and their valor. Well, these men returning home should have received the same thing, yet the Bible says they return home to a period of mourning. It should have been a glorious time because David reigns as king, yet David is crying as king. So upon their arrival, they find David being a crybaby, probably putting it nicely. Now I get he's lamenting over the death. I'm not talking about that. But he is doing it in such a way that his troops come home and the troops think he's mad at them. Because they expect to come home pomp and circumstance. They expect to come home rolling out the red carpet. And yet the first thing they see is their king sitting in the gate and he is weeping and crying. That sends a wrong message to the soldiers, does it not? And almost makes them ashamed of their king. But notice verse 4. But the king covered his face, and the king cried with a loud voice, "Oh, my son Absalom, oh, Absalom, my son, my son." This ostentatious wailing for Absalom was actually a direct violation of God's law. He shouldn't have been doing it in this way. God didn't say you can't grieve, but not in this way. In that passage in 1 Samuel, Samuel is being upset over different actions. And Saul, or God, basically says to Samuel, "Get up, go and anoint yourself and move on. Because you're doing it in a way that it's being detrimental to those around you." Leviticus 10, similar. David here is carried away with his emotions. We're not really surprised, right? You ever read through the book of Psalms? It's nothing but the emotions of David, from the highs and the lows and everything in between. And I try not to be too harsh on David, but at the same time, David is also the king of God's chosen people, and he's not acting very kingly in this moment. So notice verse 5, Joab came to the house and to the king and said, "Thou hast shamed this day the faces of all thy servants, which this day have saved thy life and the lives of thy sons and thy daughters, thy wives, and also thy concubines." By the way, David desired to be alone. That's why he hid his face. But these were pretty true words. "You have shamed these people, David. In that," verse 6, "thou lovest thine enemies, hated thy friends. For thou hast declared this day that thou regardest neither princes nor servants. For this day I perceive that if Absalom had lived and we all had died, then it had pleased thee well." Was that not a sharp contrast there from a friend? This rebuke lacks respect. There is no respect in verse 6 for David from Joab. Yet at the same time, the situation called for drastic action. It's almost as if he needed to be slapped out of the current state. He needed to change his mindset. And the easiest way Joab found to do it was saying, "You're weeping because you won the battle. Yet if all of us had died and Absalom was alive, you'd have been happy. You're not thinking about this all the way. Now therefore arise, go forth, speak comfortably unto thy servants. For I swear by the Lord, if you go not forth, we will not tarry one night with thee, or we will not tarry with thee this night, that it will be worse unto thee than all the evil that befell thee from thy youth until now." Joab was tasked with telling the truth to David, and David needed to accept that truth. King, you've got to be our king. We need a leader who can lead us from this point, because we're not back in our city. We need someone who can do this, and if you can't do that, we're going to leave you here, and we're going to go on without you. Verse 8, "And the king arose, and he sat in the gate. They told unto all the people, saying, Behold, the king does sit in the gate. And the people came before the king, and Israel had fled every man to his tent." David realized Joab's wisdom, and he takes his seat. Is David still upset about the death of Absalom? Oh, certainly. Is he still mourning his son's death? Oh, certainly. But he also realizes he has to be the king, and so he gets back to that seat where he was before. Verse 9, "And all the people were at strife throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, The king saved us out of the hand of our enemies. He delivered us out of the hand of the Philistines, and he has now fled out of the land for Absalom." See, this is that great time of grief and perplexity for Israel, because they're still kind of confused over his actions. And they say, "Well, we fled because of his son, and his son's dead, so why don't we go back and take our kingdom? And Absalom, who," verse 10, "we anointed over us, he's dead in battle. Now therefore, why speak ye not a word of bringing the king back?" By the way, only time we actually have recorded Absalom being anointed probably took place while he was in Hebron. That's where he had fled to and was trying to set up, or had started from and had tried to set up a kingdom there. David comes after the battle and he begins to cry. We move on to David. David's going to do one really stupid action here that he shouldn't have done. And if I were his political advisor, I would have said no and probably lost my life for this action. But notice here, by the way, he's going to change leadership. No need to do that. Joab is doing just fine. But he's going to go from a loyal supporter to one who is almost an enemy. Verse 11. "Then David sent to Zadok and to Abiathar the priest, saying, Speak unto the elders of Judah, saying, Why are ye the last to bring the king back to his house, seeing the speech of all Israel has come to the king, even to his house? You are my brethren, you are my bones and my flesh. Wherefore then are ye the last to bring the king back? Say ye to Amasa, art thou not of my bone and of my flesh? God do so to me, and more also, if thou be not captain of the host before me continually in the room of Joab. And he bowed the heart of all men of Judah, even as the heart of one man, so that they sent this word to the king, return thou and all thy servants. So the king returned and came to Jordan, and Judah came to Gilgal to go meet the king, to conduct the king over Jordan. So David is going to remove Joab, who has been winning battles, who has been a proven military leader, and instead he's going to put Amasa in, who, by the way, his father was not even an Israelite. And so if you're trying to stick with kin, Joab is more closely related to David than Amasa is. But David's not thinking this through. Willis, in his commentary, theorized one of three reasons for this. He wanted to prove an inducement to Joab. He wanted to punish Joab for killing Absalom. Or he wanted to punish Joab for a stern rebuke. And I could honestly see any one of those three being the reason David did this, because sometimes David would not think things through. We're going to see one of those coming back up. By the way, when he removes Joab from power, points in Amasa, this would seal Amasa's doom. Because we know a lot about David or Joab and his tendency to want to kill people. So this is not going to work out well for Amasa. Now, David is right in his policy, wanting to go in, wanting to get back to where he needs to go. But yet David acts stupidly in this decision to remove Joab. Our next thing about David, he is going to spare somebody or someone's. Beginning in verses 16 and 17, Shimei the son of Gera, a Benjamite, which was of Bahurim, hasted and came down with the men of Judah to meet King David. And there were 1,000 men of Benjamin with him, and Ziba, the servant of the house of Saul, and his 15 sons and his 20 servants with him. They went over Jordan before the king. The reason there are so many men, that proves that he was a great influence. Now, Ziba would be a representative of all the household of Saul. We've already talked about Ziba in our study here of 2 Samuel. But he is showing back up, and they're helping the king get over the Jordan as they're trying to make it back to Jerusalem. We see in verse 18, they went over a ferry boat to carry over the king's household to do what he thought good. And Shimei, the son of Gera, fell down before the king as he was come over the Jordan. Valuable assistance given. You couldn't just cross the Jordan easily, so they had to have a boat that could ferry them across. That's not a new concept of crossing water by ferry. It's a biblical concept. And they said unto the king, after he is bowed down, let not my lord impute iniquity unto me, neither do thou remember that which thy servant did perversely, the day that the Lord my king went out of Jerusalem, that the king should take it to his heart. Look at verse 20. For the servant doth know that I have sinned. Therefore, behold, I am come the first this day of all the house of Joseph to go down to meet my lord the king. Interesting phrase here, the house of Joseph. There's a cross-referencing that with Amos 5 and 6, a reference to the 10 northern tribes, the house of Joseph. Shimei is a weak man and may be looked at as a selfish hypocrite for the actions that he is doing here. But Abishai, verse 21, the son of Zeruiah answered and said, shall not Shimei be put to death for this, because he cursed the Lord's anointed? Now, to kill the Lord's anointed, we learn from 1 Samuel 24, 6 and 10, also 26 and verse 9, it was a serious crime if you were to kill the Lord's anointed. Had they tried to kill Saul, they should have been put to death. Same with David, the same would be with Solomon. You kill the Lord's anointed, you are to be put to death and your family to be cursed. That's God's chosen vessel to lead his people. Well, here he says they have put a curse on the people. But I want you to notice an interesting phrase in verse 22. David said, what do I have to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah, that you should this day be adversaries unto me? Shall there any man be put to death this day in Israel? For do not I know that I this day am king over Israel? an interesting phrase. He says, "You should be adversaries unto me." Literally in Hebrew translated, "That ye be for me a Satan." Who is Satan? Well, he is our adversary. He's the devil, right? 1 Peter 5:8 walks about as a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Literally in Hebrew says, "Why are you being a Satan to me this day? Why are you being an adversary for me this day? Am not I the king? Do not I make the decisions?" Oh, by the way, David's a forerunner of Christ. I find that interesting that he talks about being pestered with a Satan, if you will. And we just sang a song. "Seek ye first, man shall not live by bread alone." That's Matthew 4 and verse 4, where Jesus is being tempted of Satan. Literally, the Satan, not just a Satan. He says, "Why are you being a Satan for me this day?" Therefore, verse 23, "The king said unto Shimei, thou shalt not die, and the king swear unto him." Why does he do this? Oh, because he'd already made an oath to Shimei in the second chapter. He's the one that David spares. Now, he spares him here, and he spared him a few times before, but at the end of his life, David may instruct his son Solomon to kill Shimei, and so he may not really make good on that promise forever, but in this moment, he still spares him. In this moment, he still keeps that promise going. We don't have time to go into the book of Kings to prophesy about that. But David keeps his promise here. The next thing we learn about David is David's going to leave. David's got to get out of Dodge. We'll read verses 24 through 30, then comment. "And Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king, and had neither dressed his feet, nor trimmed his beard, nor washed his clothes, from the day the king departed until the day he came again in peace. And it came to pass, when he was come to Jerusalem to meet the king, that the king said unto him, Wherefore wentest thou not with me, Mephibosheth? And he answered, My lord, O king, my servant deceived me. For thy servant said, I will saddle me an ass, that I may ride thereon and go to the king, because thy servant is lame. And he has slandered thy servant unto my lord the king, but my lord the king is as an angel of God. Go do therefore what is good in thine eyes. For all my father's house were but dead men before my lord the king. Ye didst thou set thy servant among them that did eat at thine own table. What right therefore have I yet to cry any more to the king? And the king said unto him, Why speakest thou any more of this matter? I have said, Thou and Ziba divide the land. And Mephibosheth said unto the king, Yea, let him take off, for as much as my lord the king has come again in peace into his own house. Now, when it says in verse 24, Jonathan his father, Saul, the son of Saul, he's really a grandson of Saul. Jonathan is his son. But Mephibosheth gives proof of his truth simply by the way he is dressed. He is disheveled. He is, we would say, dirty, wearing old dirty clothes. His hair is unkempt. He hasn't bathed. I think about sports fanatics who, as soon as their team enters the playoffs, they don't shave their beard. You've seen these men. They don't shave their beard until their team loses. I think about Mephibosheth. He hasn't shaved his beard till his king came home. And now he meets the king, and that's the only proof that he needs, that David needs to know this is true. But David has a dilemma. He's already given Mephibosheth's property to Ziba because David was deceived. David was deceived by Ziba, and now David is upset about this. But what I like about his answer is very reminiscent of the story of his son Solomon, right? When the two women come to him, what does he do? He says, well, just divide the child in half and give one half to one, one half the other. Of course, in that story, the child would have died. But notice here, he just says, well, just give them half. I'll give you half and I'll give the other one half. But I love the way that Mephibosheth answers. Yea, take off, for as much as my lord the king has come again in peace into his own house. Mephibosheth's answer is very similar to one of the harlots that answered Solomon, right? Well, just let it be done, whatever you say. The other one said, no, let her have it, because that's my son. David's got to leave. And in the process, David tries to make good on this promise to Mephibosheth by giving him the land that truly is his. Now, our final passage, which takes up a big bulk of Scripture, we probably will not read all these verses, so you can read them this afternoon on your own comfort. But David is going to return. Remember, our title of our lesson is From Jordan to Jerusalem. And we just read, we just crossed, he just ferried over the Jordan River. Now he's got to get to Jerusalem. David's going to make an offer beginning in verse 31. Barzillai the Gilead came down from Rogelim over the Jordan with the king to conduct over Jordan. Now he was a very aged man, even 80, that'd be 80 years old. He provided the king of sustenance while he lay at Mahanaim. He was a very great man, and the king said, "Come thou over with me, and I will feed thee in Jerusalem." David is basically making an offer for all those people round about him. You come back with me. You took care of me while I was away from my house. I will now give you a new place to live. Be glad to assist you in that. But he will decline. He will decline because he says, "I'm already 80 years old." And he knows that his life is nearing its end. And so he knows that he's not going to partake of the king's blessings for too terribly much longer. He would rather them go to someone who can enjoy them for a longer span in life. But David still makes this offer. Look here in verse 37. "Let thy servant, I pray thee, turn back again, that I may die in mine own city and be buried by the grave of my father and my mother. But behold, my servant Chimham, let him go over my lord the king and do unto him which shall seem good unto thee." Now Josephus will comment, not biblically, but he will still make a comment on this, that Chimham was probably his son, but a son who also served in a servant role. Maybe something had gone where he'd lost completely his sonship. This may have been a way of restoring that blessing unto him. But I want you to jump down to verse 40. "Then the king went on to Gilgal, and Chimham," or Chimhan, also could be translated with an N on the end, "went on with him, and all the king of Judah conducted the king, and also half of the people of Israel." A very ominous words, does it not? Notice that. All the people of Judah and half the people of Israel. The very ominous words indicate there's already a separation going on. You know, if you go back and read historical writings of the 1840s and the 1850s, and you really dive into some of those important documents, there is no wonder why our country split in 1861. It wasn't an overnight decision that 13 states would secede the Union and try to fight for their freedoms. It had been a long time coming. Well, here, the division that will happen with Solomon's son, Rehoboam, it's been a long time coming. We could really see some of that really back to the time of Judges. There was a little bit of discrepancy, and then they thought, if we have a king that will bring us all together, which was not God's plan, that king further divided them. David tries to bring them together. They're not all unified towards the end of his reign. Solomon is just Solomon and has too many wives to deal with the people, and so division occurs. Look at verse 41. "Behold, all the men of Israel came to the king and said, 'Why have our brethren, the men of Judah, stolen thee away and have brought the king and his household and all of David's men with him over Jordan?'" See, each part was jealous of the king's favor. Tribal jealousy and bitterness marred would have been a happy end to a rebellion. You have Solomon's men who have come back. And now the problem is not David versus Solomon, it's north versus south. It's Israel versus Judah. And so one doesn't like that David likes the other one. And so they're asking back and forth all of these questions. And verse 43, "The men of Judah answered Israel answered the men of Judah and said, 'We have 10 parts in the king. We also have more right in David than you do. Why do you then despise us that our advice should not be first had in bringing back our king?' And the words of the men of Judah were fiercer than the words of the men of Israel." Judah annoyed the northerners. Sheba will see an opportunity for a rebellion. If you think about it, since there are 12 tribes, 10 is a bigger number than 2, last time I checked. So they think they have more of the king, but really it should have been an equal balance. It was one kingdom altogether. Yet luckily, David will make it back. He's actually going to enter Jerusalem in chapter 20. That's the king returns. But David has gone a long way in a long chapter. Very quickly, 3 lessons for you. Number one, David spent a period loudly mourning Absalom. Now, there is a time to mourn over our loved ones. We know that to be true. Solomon backs that up, Ecclesiastes 3. Yet we need to be careful not let this period of mourning keep us from being faithful to God. I've met individuals who have lost a dear loved one in their life, and it's like they just quit living life. They quit going to church. They quit being active. You can't do that. Do you mourn? Oh, yes. You probably still mourn them to this very day, but you've got to progress forward. David had to learn that lesson the hard way. Number two, David was mad at Joab, and because of this, David made a stupid decision that might could be said it was done in anger. We never need to let our anger get the best of us. Give place unto the devil. Never let the sun go down upon your wrath. Paul will say in Ephesians 4, be angry and sin not. He doesn't say don't be angry. He says be angry and sin not. Yet here David is angry, and he just, without even thinking, he just removes Joab from position. Number three, the tribes of God people were not unified behind David. Jesus Christ said it best, which Abraham Lincoln would borrow, if a house be divided against itself, that house cannot stand. We are to strive together to be unified, not only in this church, but also with the church universal. Always doing thus, says the Lord, following the same pattern and teaching it for what it says, not what we think it says. But thankfully, David's out of Jordan, and he's on his way to Jerusalem. That will suffice our time for today. I know a lot in that chapter, but I hope it was a beneficial study for you as it was for me. As we look forward to the return of Christ, we need to make sure that we're ready for His return. Just as the King returned to Jerusalem, Christ is going to return this earth, never set foot on it again. He's going to return, take us home to heaven. If you are not a Christian this morning, you do that by hearing, believing, repenting, confessing, being baptized. You go down that watery grave, come up a new creature alive in Christ. If you're not a Christian, we'd love to assist you with that. Dear Christian friend, you need to keep going, remaining faithful to the very end, knowing that's when you receive your reward and not a moment sooner. If you're not faithful, need prayers of strength or to be restored, we'd love to assist you in that with well. Please let it be known while we stand and while we sing.